Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, a show where we speak to the top thought leaders in health innovation, health policy, care delivery, and the great minds who are shaping the healthcare of the future. This week, Mark and Margaret speak with Dr. Stephen Wolf, Distinguished Chair in Population Health at Virginia Commonwealth University and Health Equity Director Emeritus and Senior Advisor at the VCU Center on Society and Health. He talks about the just-released report showing a decline in life expectancy among working-age adults in the U.S., a result of lingering effects of the recession, the opioid crisis, and other so-called deaths of despair. Lori Robertson also checks in, managing editor of factcheck.org, looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain, separating the fake from the facts. And we end with a bright idea that's improving health and well-being in everyday lives. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can also hear us by asking Alexa to play the program Conversations on Healthcare. Now, stay tuned for our interview with Dr. Stephen Wolf of the VCU Center on Society and Health here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
And we're speaking today with Dr. Stephen Wolf, Distinguished Chair in Population Health at Virginia Commonwealth University and Director Emeritus in Population Health and Health Equity at VCU Center on Society and Health, where they conduct in-depth research on social epidemiology. He earned his MD at Emory University and his Master's of Public Health at Johns Hopkins University, and did his residency in both family medicine at Fairfax Family Medicine and in prevention and public health at Johns Hopkins. Dr. Wolf, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Pleasure to be here.
Well, you know, your study is the straw that's stirring the drink, I think, in conversations around the country. And you just released this, I think, very concerning report indicating this substantial decline in life expectancy in America. And the report is life expectancy and mortality in the United States, 1959 through 2017. And it really lays out this rise in mortality among working aged adults from 25 to 64 years of age. And I wonder if you could share with our listeners the more important findings and what it bodes for the overall life expectancy in the United States.
Well, you stated one of the most important findings, which is that the working age population is experiencing this increase in mortality, which basically means American adults are more likely to die before age 65 than adults in other countries. That's pretty alarming. The life expectancy decrease also is actually not a new phenomenon. It's decades in the making. Life expectancy is supposed to be increasing, and that's been the case for the past century in most industrialized countries. And in the United States as well, ours has been increasing for many years. But in the 1980s, the pace at which we were increasing began to fall off. It plateaued in 2009. And it's been decreasing for the past 3 years.
Well, Dr. Wolf, I think there's no other word to describe it but shocking, right? But it's not really a new onset phenomena. The wheels that have been driving this drop in life expectancy actually probably began moving backwards in the 1980s. I think you've said that the Great Recession, in the wake of the Great Recession, the pace accelerated, and certainly some regions were hit much harder than others. There's been a saying for a while that your zip code may have more to do with your health than your genetic code. So maybe if you could help us and our listeners understand, let's just take the recession. How did that impact population health? And how has that actually been manifested in some of these higher mortality rates for middle-aged Americans?
Well, the recession did not help matters, I can say that. Certainly it had a severe impact on the whole country, but it's one that's really lingered for marginalized communities and populations that have been historically disadvantaged. But I think it's actually important to emphasize that the economic stresses that middle class and low income families have been facing in this country predate the recession. It really does go back to the 1980s that you mentioned, when our economy underwent this major transformation that resulted in the loss of manufacturing jobs, steel mills closed, coal industry and so forth were really deeply affected. And a lot of middle income workers who had depended on those industries for their livelihoods and the communities in which they lived began feeling the strain. And we feel that these health trends that we're reporting now are really the symptoms of the long-term exposure to those economic stresses. The recession certainly hurt those folks even further, but I think the health insult was already underway well before that.
It's kind of interesting to listen to the conversations going on the political trail. Certainly the conversations about income inequality is also a public health conversation.
Right.
Speaking of public health, certainly the devastating expansion of the opioid epidemic, which has led to hundreds of thousands of deaths. Thank God for somebody like Narcan, which
or
has probably saved
tens
of thousands, if not more, lives. I'm wondering if you could just focus in now, moving from the income inequality to the opioid crisis. I think you've called these, whether it's alcohol abuse or suicide or opioid, really deaths of despair, how they've played a role in the increased mortality.
Well, it might be helpful to start just by unpacking what's behind this increase in working age mortality. So drug overdoses fueled by the opioid epidemic are the leading contributor for that increase by far. There are many other factors, but it's the major player in driving the trend. There's also been an increase in deaths from alcoholism and suicides that was reported over several years. And it was not me actually, but other researchers who coined this term deaths of despair in an attempt to try to weave together some explanation for those three causes. But our study found increases in 35 causes of death in this age group. And it extended well beyond substance abuse and suicides to include a variety of chronic diseases. So while clearly opioids and drug addiction are major priorities in trying to solve this problem, it's actually more pervasive.
Well, Dr. Wolf, one of the tenets of the work that we do in community health centers is that you will find disparities in health status based purely on racial and ethnic grounds. But your study is a little more nuanced and has really looked at this, I think, in a very sophisticated and complex way. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about where racial and ethnic disparities fall in this, as well as the role that economic disparities play, and how do we begin to look at this across our very varied society in the United States?
So historically, communities of color, particularly African Americans and other minority groups, have experienced disproportionately high mortality rates and shorter life expectancy than non-Hispanic whites in our country. And that's obviously been a focus not only at community health centers, but public health at large in trying to close that gap. And actually some great progress has been made.
Absolutely.
The initial studies reporting this increase in middle-aged mortality, which was around 2015 that a lot of press attention went to it, claimed that it was only happening in whites, that it was not occurring in African Americans or other groups. The reason they said that, though, is because data that had not yet become available showing that it is, in fact, increasing in other racial and ethnic groups as well. We have so many people just in absolute number that are white in this country, but also there may be some differences in how this is playing out across cultures and across groups with different histories in terms of privilege and disadvantage. The important point to realize, though, is that even with this increase in white mortality, it doesn't even come close to the mortality rate in African Americans. And the sad thing is that although we were making some progress in lowering the black-white mortality gap, in recent years, because of this trend now affecting communities of color, we're seeing a reversal, and some of the progress that we had made is now being erased by this trend of increasing midlife mortality.
We're speaking today with Dr. Stephen Wolf, Distinguished Chair in Population Health at Virginia Commonwealth University and Director Emeritus in Population Health and Health Equity at VCU Center on Society and Health. You know, I pull the thread on that a little, because a little counterintuitive in the sense that we've had the Affordable Care Act out there for a number of years. 20 million Americans gained coverage. I think we saw some positive results in a couple of studies that showed that it had an uptick. Are you able to measure the impact about the expanded health coverage and how Medicaid might have impacted? Medicaid now has grown to about 75 million, 76 million people covered. So what's the correlation between coverage and outcome?
First, I should just emphasize that there's evidence from other studies, not ours, about the health benefits associated with Medicaid expansion.
Yeah.
And of course, broader health benefits for closing the gap in the uninsured. So the disconnect, however, has to do with two factors. There's only so much importance to healthcare. And this I'm saying as a physician, research has shown that healthcare only accounts for about 10 to 20% right. of our health outcomes. So even if we were to arrive at the perfect healthcare system, we would probably still be seeing this health trend because it's really being driven by conditions outside the clinic that are responsible for this increase in morbidity and mortality. We have to have access to good care, but the root causes of this lie in the conditions that we're living in. The other thing I want to emphasize is that although it's only been apparent in recent years that life expectancy is decreasing, the process was underway, as we said, some years ago. And what happened was that although death rates were increasing from causes like drug overdoses and alcoholism and suicides and the other ones we mentioned, we were making important gains in other areas. So right. death rates from ischemic heart disease,
right.
from HIV/AIDS, from right. cancer were decreasing. And they were offsetting those increases in mortality from those other causes. What's happened in recent years is that we've reached the tipping point where the increase in drug overdoses and the others has become so large and so voluminous that it has overwhelmed the health gains that we achieve. And now we're starting to see that rise in all-cause mortality. But it's a mistake to think that to draw some correlation, for example, to the Affordable Care Act or to any recent policies and assume that those are responsible for this trend when clearly the dynamic was in play some years ago. Mm-hmm.
Well, you've referred to this as a distinctly American phenomenon. And while life expectancy in this country is declining, the opposite is true in all other affluent nations, which I think is, you've said, and your colleagues in this area of research say that we've got to pay more attention to social determinants of health. I think you were once quoted as saying that we would do better to make sure that teens graduate from high school, that it would have more impact than any new blockbuster drug that might come on the market. So the changes that we need in terms of population health and the social determinants of health all seem to me come out of policy. And I wonder if you'd like to highlight some of the ones that you and your colleagues think are the most important when it comes to reversing this trend.
Well, I think there's great opportunity in improving the social conditions, not only for our health, but for economic mobility. When I talk about this, it's not like the solution to this health problem is some new medical discovery,
right.
some new drug that we need. The very policy changes that we talk about for helping the middle class, promoting social mobility, economic development of our marginalized communities are the same ones that will improve our health. So it's getting access to a good education, jobs that pay livable wages, affordable housing, transportation infrastructure. Those are the things that communities need and families need to thrive economically and to provide security for their children. I don't think those all come from government necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
There's an important role for government policy at the federal, state, and local level, but a lot of it comes from the private sector in mm-hmm. terms of creating economic opportunity, and we see examples of that across the country.
You know, I want to pull the thread on Margaret's first part of Margaret's question, which dealt with other countries. And I'm wondering to what extent you can look at best practices or what are we seeing that's different in those countries? Is it really on the opioid side or is it because they have less of an income difference going on in the population? What are you seeing and there's any best practice that we can try to contemplate?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, one of the first things to say is that sometimes people push back on the comparison between the United States and these other countries because they are so different.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not Finland, we're not Norway, we're not Japan. They feel that because we have such a diverse population, there's some who incorrectly assume that our health disadvantage is due to this diversity.
Yeah.
But as we just discussed, the largest increase in mortality is in non-Hispanic whites. And other studies that we've done over the years have shown that Americans across many different subgroups do worse than their peers in other countries.
Mm-hmm.
So rich Americans have worse health than rich people in other countries. Insured Americans do worse than mm-hmm. people coverage in other countries. One possible explanation for that might be that these other countries provide stronger support systems for families and communities that fall on hard times. So it's not that people aren't unemployed or poor in other countries, but programs and services are in place so that they can get through those times without it affecting their health as deeply as it does in this country, where there's more of a culture of expecting people to fend for themselves when times get rough. There are other differences. You mentioned the opioid epidemic, which does not exist in most of these other countries. The marketing of OxyContin and other prescription opioids that was so pervasive in this country was not allowed in many of these other countries. Hmm. So there are other regulations and advertising contexts that may also explain some of the differences we're seeing.
Well, there are some bright spots in the report. It's kind of an odd one that people living in our coastal areas in the United States have seen some slight improvements in life expectancy. But it really does point to some of the widening disparities, urban versus rural. But you're determined to get to the root cause of this disparity in outcomes, and we want to cheer you on in that work. And we'd love to hear more about the partnership that your institute is participating in, a national committee funded by the National Academy of Sciences and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, to really dig down in greater depth.
I'm a member of a committee that the National Academy of Sciences has established to look at this trend of increasing midlife mortality. And it's brought together experts from around the country mm-hmm. to sort of put their heads together and review the evidence and try to get a better sense of what's behind this trend and what explanations might be brought to bear to understand what to do about it. I do want to go back, though, to the point you made about the areas of the country that are doing well. Our study was a state-level analysis. So we, mm-hmm. we looked at the states. So the Pacific states, as you mentioned, California, Oregon, and so forth, did relatively well. But as you mentioned a few minutes ago, our zip code is very important to mm-hmm. our health.
Right.
You zoom in on any of these states
right.
that look,
right.
at, look like they're doing well.
Yep.
If you're in South LA or areas of Sacramento or Oakland, you're not seeing those positive health trends.
Absolutely.
And so we see this pervasively across the country, 15 or 20 year differences in life expectancy across census tracts that are just separated by 2 or 3 miles. So we need to have that broader national perspective and see what states and regions are doing well and not doing well, but also think about local neighborhood level solutions mm-hmm. that are really powerful influences yeah. on our health.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Stephen Wolfe, Distinguished Chair in Population Health at Virginia Commonwealth University and Director Emeritus in Population Health and Health Equity at VCU's Center on Society and Health. You can find his report on the recent edition of the Journal of American Medical Association, JAMA, and you can follow his work by going to societyhealth.vcu.edu. Dr. Wolfe, thank you so much for your contribution to public health, animating the conversation for so many people. I think this is a conversation that really everybody needs to be engaged in. And also, thank you for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare.
My pleasure, and thank you for bringing attention to this issue.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
In the November Democratic debate, Senator Bernie Sanders said that the United Nations is projecting, quote, hundreds of millions of climate refugees in the years to come as a result of climate change. The UN, however, doesn't currently endorse a particular estimate, and the term climate refugee is in many ways problematic. His remark is similar to a comment the UN Deputy High Commissioner for Refugees made in 2008. While at a climate change conference, the official said that between 200 million and 250 million people would be displaced by 2050 because of global warming. But that figure is likely flawed, and it was also more than a decade ago. More recent statements from UN officials do not indicate the agency endorses an estimate. In 2011, for instance, the High Commissioner for Refugees said there was no consensus on a number, and a 2016 FAQ available on the agency's website says, quote, "it is hard to say," end quote, how many people will be displaced by climate change. Scholars in the field don't use the term climate refugee because refugee has a very specific meaning in international law. For one, the term refugee applies to those crossing international borders. Research shows people affected by climate change usually move within a country first. In 2014, the UN's International Organization for Migration stated in a report that there was great uncertainty about the figures, noting that the forecasts for the number of environmental migrants by mid-century vary widely between 25 million and 1 billion. The actual figure, the report explained, will depend on a host of factors that are largely unknowable at this point. For more, see our website at factcheck.org. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of factcheck.org.
Factcheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have factcheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. It's estimated that a majority of a person's lifelong health expenditures are often spent in the final months of life. But death is one of those topics that generates the least amount of conversation in the clinical setting. For folks who end up critically ill or facing a terminal diagnosis like late-stage cancer, this can often lead to poorly communicated end-of-life wishes being discussed with the clinician, who then often resorts to extreme interventions.
There's this unspoken misconception that by having honest conversations about prognosis, that we are somehow removing the hope that patients are coming to us looking for. And actually, most studies that have evaluated this have shown that when you provide honest prognostic information to patients and allow patients to be part of the decision-making about their goals of care, they actually have more understanding of their disease process and better satisfaction with their care overall.
Dr. Manali Patel is a clinical researcher at Stanford University School of Medicine. Her earlier research at Stanford had yielded an interesting finding. Late-stage cancer patients felt more comfortable talking about end-of-life issues with a layperson as opposed to a clinician. She and her fellow researchers followed patients at the Veterans Administration Palo Alto Healthcare System for 15 months after they were diagnosed with stage 3 or 4 or recurrent cancer. Half the people were randomly assigned to speak with a lay worker about the goals of care over a 6-month period, and the lay workers were given a rigorous 80-hour course and clinical observations before being assigned to the study.
She learned as she went. And as the project went through the cycles of starting the implementation and then ramping up, and then at the end, she came to that realization that these conversations really are not scary. We had hired her specifically because of her service orientation and because she had a very supportive ear. And that's really the main crux of this intervention, was finding the right person.
92% of the participants who received the layperson intervention, compared to only 18% of the control group, were likely to have end-of-life directives in their electronic health record and more likely to have communicated their wishes to their clinicians as well, often choosing hospice over emergency room interventions. The health costs of both groups varied as well. The average cost of care for the intervention group in the last month of life was about $1,000 versus $23,000 for the control group. Dr. Patel said one of the more interesting findings was much higher patient satisfaction.
We found that the satisfaction scores went up for the patients in the intervention arm, but they went down for patients in the control arm, as well as the satisfaction with decision-making across all 6 scores of the satisfaction with decision scale. We found overwhelmingly that the patients in the intervention arm were very satisfied with the decisions that they had made regarding their medical treatments, but the patients in the control arm really did not have much movement at all in terms of how satisfied they were.
A low-resource, compassionate, patient-centered intervention that assists terminally ill patients, their families, and their clinicians to have a frank discussion about end-of-life wishes, improving patient satisfaction at such a sensitive and challenging time, that's a bright idea.
You've been listening to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare is recorded at WESU, at Wesleyan University, streaming live at chcradio.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. The show is brought to you by the Community Health Center.